All right, this lecture is entitled Five Ways to Improve Your Delivery. Matt's going to give two ways, I'm going to give two ways, and then we're going to share a third way. Sharing is caring, kids. The first key to improving your delivery is to read your judge. Now, reading your judge is a pretty complicated idea, and there's a lot of subtleness to it, but we're going to go over some of the key points with it. The first is to recognize that all communication is two-way. If it isn't two-way, it isn't communication. Let me ask you this. If I go out into a woods and there's nothing around, and I start talking and delivering my speech, am I actually communicating? The answer is no, because I'm not speaking to anyone. It's actually impossible for communication to be one-way. When it becomes one-way, it ceases to be communication. For instance, if I say, Matt, how are you doing today? Then it's implied that he's going to respond. In other situations, I might say, Matt, you look tired. Now, I'm not necessarily looking for him to respond and say, yes, John, I am tired. But as I said that, the look on his face is telling me, John, stop talking. You're annoying me. That is communication as well. It's non-verbal, but it is communication. So when you are speaking in a debate round, even though you are the only one talking, that does not mean you are the only one communicating. Communication is two-way, and all communication in the debate round is focused on your judge. So even though your judge never really talks throughout the debate round, or they shouldn't anyway, you are still communicating with them, and they are giving you feedback. Have you ever had a judge where, you know, you say something, and they're just kind of like, they nod their head and they write down? That is communicating, yeah, that was a good point. Or you say something, the judge does this look of confusion, then you're like, oh, okay, that wasn't a good point.
Or they look so bored right now.
So the first thing to do is to watch your judge's note-taking habit. Some judges will hyperflow everything, and they will always be sitting like this, head down, flowing. And so you'll never really see their facial expressions very much because they'll have their head down flowing. Some judges will hardly flow at all, and they'll write down a word here, a word there, if they think it's important. Try to figure out early on in the round what type of flower your judge is. If they're a hyperflower who always has their head down, it doesn't mean that you're doing a bad job that they have their head down, that they're not looking at you. It means they're trying to write down everything you say. If you have a judge that, you know, looks up at the competitors and then looks down to write down, you know, the tags for their points, then that means that judge is only going to write something down when you make a new point. So there's no point in, you know, talking about the point you just made for over 2 minutes, because they're not going to write anything new down. So learn what type of note taker your judge is. And you can't just ask the judge that, like, what type of flower are you, Matt?
Well, as a matter of fact, I like to flow quite a lot. Thank you, John.
Yes, thank you, Matt. That's not going to work out very well in the majority of situations. Learning to watch your judge is important. During your AC, you can watch the judge, because it's pre-written. And as the year goes on, your AC won't necessarily be fully memorized, but you'll kind of know where you're at on the page. So you can look up every now and then and notice what the judge is doing. If you're negative, this is your opportunity in between flowing the affirmative case yourself to look at the judge and notice how the judge is flowing the affirmative case. So watch your judge's note-taking habits. Also, watch your judge's facial expressions. I am a ridiculously expressive judge. I sit there and judge, and somebody will bring up a point, and if I think it's a dumb point, then I will just go, and write it down. And you know very clearly that I thought your point was dumb, so if you want me to actually vote for you based off of that point, you better really sell that point to me. Conversely, if I thought it was a great point, then I'll be like, and I'll write it down. And during cross-ex, I'm especially bad. The cross-examiner will ask her, especially like hard-hitting question, I'll go, and just look at the questioner with this like, I want to see how you're going to get out of this one. And then if the person being questioned comes back with this really great response, I just go. And I don't feel bad about this because I feel like I do it pretty fairly for both sides. And I feel like debaters debate better when they get more feedback from their judge. As opposed to the judge that just goes.
I prefer feedback.
Yeah, exactly. But there's definitely a line when you become alumni and you start judging, and that you'll figure out that there's this line of like, what are you doing? But watch your judge's facial expressions. They're important. For me, if you, you know, have me judging you, my facial expressions are going to be pretty obvious. Some judges, their facial expression may just be stone-faced and then That'll be it. And that will be the, oh no, I have seriously messed up. Like, that should just register for you. Other judges, you'll say something and the judge will just be like, what? And then you'll just be like, oh no, the round is over. No.
It's usually.
What, the next thing is, watch your judge's body language. Here's what my mother does, and this kind of goes in with note-taking, but she hyper-flows. She flows everything. But if she feels you're not saying anything new, then there's no point in writing down what you're saying. So if you're reiterating, you know, the same argument multiple different ways, which a lot of people do for judges to understand this, she sits back and she's usually sitting there, you know, blowing like this, sets down her pen and just leans back in her chair, arms crossed, with a very attentive face on her. But this is my mom's face of like, all right, you're this close to losing me because you already talked about this enough. Move on. And that. So watch your judge's body language. And body language in this case is pretty much everything that the judge does that is nonverbal and is not their facial expressions. So for instance, if your judge is sitting there and they're twiddling their thumbs like this, this is body language for you're really not that interesting. My thumbs are more interesting than you. Conversely, if your judge is, say, just really hunched over the flow pad going like this, and you're probably like, oh, they're probably concentrating really hard. Judges, you can, to a certain extent, tell how emotionally invested judges in an argument, and then you'll start talking about children dying or whatever, and you see they slowly straighten up, or if their foot slides down. Typically, if your judge has both feet planted flat on the ground, they're sitting somewhat straight, you know, that might be kind of hunched like this, but they're not leaned back in their chair. And they're flowing. That is body language for all systems go. You're doing a good job.
Is it leaning back in your chair? Is a lot different than scooting the chair back slowly or drawing away from the table the entire body. This says emotional overload. You are screaming and pounding the table. I am scared.
You are scaring me.
And so read that also. Scooting in the chair is like, all right, we're really getting into this kind of thing. But also leaning back and scooting back. Beware of the scooting back the chair. That is dangerous. It can be very useful sometimes if you're just like really trying to reach a climax and you're just about to let things get comfortable, because sometimes it's nice to kind of mix things up, but in general, avoid that.
Literally whole books written on body language and the science of body language. This is just to get you thinking on this topic. All right, move on to point two.
Prescripting. For those of you that weren't in on prescripting cross-examination, you have a claim, a warrant, and an impact. Basically, prescripting an argument is done the same way. You make a claim, you prove it, you give some reason why your claim is true, either logic, you give an example, or you quote some kind of notable philosopher, something along those lines, and then you give impact, and that's where you tell the judge how much the argument matters. Like when we were talking about dropping arguments, I talked about impact a little bit there. Show the judge exactly how the argument weighs on the round. So you construct a prescripted rebuttal, just like you would prescript or write a contention, only with these rebuttals, what you kind of things you want to start prescripting against are first priority are common arguments against your case. This includes new applications for the 1AR if you have time. What this means is common arguments against your case. Once you've been running your case, you've gone to a tournament, maybe you've done a piranha pack type thing at your club where everyone looks at your case and tells you everything that's wrong with it or all the arguments they would have against it. And after you've looked at your case and seen, well, this is how I would attack the case, this is what I'm planning on opponents responding to, 90% of the time, your opponents are not going to throw a new argument that you've never heard before at your case, unless you're just starting a new case. So when you get used to a lot of those different arguments that are commonly coming up against your case, it would be a good idea to prescript a response. Now, what I mean by prescript is not that you are necessarily going to read off of a page, just like you would with your case. But prescripting is basically saying, this is what my response is going to be, and this is a piece of evidence that I like to use. For example, if you're running the value of justice, for obvious reasons, it might not be the greatest thing. It's a little bit vague. Well, without a criterion, but your opponent would probably almost every time run some argument around like justice is vague or something like that. And so you can know pretty consistently, if I run the value of justice, my opponent's going to respond to it by saying that it is vague. So you can really begin to prepare for the common arguments against your case. So figure out what is what arguments are coming up against and get ready for those. But the second priority are common values. The first step here is to make a list of every value that you see. Every time you run against a new value or a new criterion for that matter, because criterions are also useful to get prescripted against, write them down on a page of paper. Almost like that application list that we were talking about creating. You also want to have a list of all the values that you run against. This is useful for a lot of reasons. First of all, you can get used to all the different values that are out there, all the different values to respond to. But also when you're trying to write a new case, perhaps, it's nice to have a list of values that you can come from. But anyways, make a list of every value you see. And then one thing I didn't put down here is prioritize. Figure out which values are the most common and deal with those ones first. So for instance, if you ran against the value of security 5 times and you run against freedom 4 times and every other value on your list you've only seen once or twice, you probably want to deal with ones like freedom and security first. Then when you make a list of arguments against their value, prescripting arguments, limit yourself to 3 or 4 responses per value. This should all fit on a single sheet of paper when you're prescripting against a value. The reason is if you have any more than that, you're simply going to overwhelm your judge or run out of time. I remember a time I was debating this guy. He says, now I have 18 responses to my opponent's value. I'm sitting there just kind of, I've been down this road before, I'm smiling. I'm like, yeah, okay, 18 responses to my value, let's see how this goes. And he just had a brief against my value of general welfare. And for his entire, and I say almost his entire negative rebuttal, before he even got onto his own case, he just read 18 responses to my value. And to be honest, the fact is there really isn't 18 responses to the value of general welfare. He was repeating himself, let's say, quite a lot. So it made it really easy for me to respond to each of his points just by cross-applying. The reason you need to limit yourself to 3 or 4 responses is, to be honest, there's probably only 3 or 4 responses out there that are high-quality arguments. Second of all, even if you have 15 high-quality arguments, you're simply wasting your time. To be honest, 1 or maybe 2 responses to your opponent's value is enough. Also, when you're prescripting against values, you may want to try prescripting some cross-examination questions. We talked about this in my lecture on how to attack the value, some questions that you might use against that. The third thing that you want to prescript against is common applications. Common applications. What I might mean by scripting against is not looking up applications for your case or just applications to know more about it, but actually trying to come up with briefs against your opponent's applications. Now, just like with values, make a list and then attack them one at a time. Now, the problem I found is that a lot of people start with trying to prescript against every application out there. I really don't think it's a good idea to start with prescripting against applications. It's the most time consuming and yields the least results. I mean, think about it this way. An application, there's probably going to be dozens and dozens of applications out there. In the example of the privacy resolution, there's going to be thousands and thousands that are possible. But you're really only going to use that evidence brief a couple times. Now, the exception to this is applications that are in your case. You definitely want to script arguments for and against it because you want to know what kind of arguments they're going to use against your applications. So once again, the first priority is going to be your case. Second priority is values. Third priority is common applications. What not to prescript against? Every single case that you run up against. I know a lot of people that have a list of every case out there and they want to individually come up with a custom response to every case that they go up against. That is simply going to take way too much time. Do you have any idea how many cases you are going to see? Let's say you go to a tournament and there's 6 rounds in prelims. It's double flighted, so you see 6 more. That's 12 cases. That's 18 because the one that you were watching, you're seeing 2 debaters, not just the one you're debating. So there's 18 cases in prelims. If you go to out rounds, maybe you watch two out rounds. That's another four. That's 22 cases just per tournament that you're going to come up against. Multiply that by, say, the six tournaments that you're going to go in the year. We're talking about 130-something different cases out there that just you have collected. Now, what about all the cases that your club has collected and all the flows that are shared with among your club mates? There are probably, I know in STOA there was 400 debaters last year. That's 800 cases. There is, there was like 800 cases at NITOC. There is no possible, in NCFCA, it's even way more. There are even way more debaters in the NCFCA. So for that reason, this is simply not an option. Prescripting cases is what I like to call the annoying case. This is the case that you have debated three times and it has defeated you every single time. It is undefeated. It carried your opponent through out rounds and he won finals. And you just simply can't understand what is so great about this case and you want to destroy it. There are some really annoying cases out there that people want to destroy. I remember, if there's a really annoying case out there, you could prescript against that. Oh, speaking drills.
Yep.
So this one's mine. I actually take the first three. All right. So this is the third key to improving your delivery, and that's speaking drills. Now, I'm just going to do a little thing on talk about speaking drills in general. The good thing about speaking drills is that they really get you speaking. Unlike all of these other things that we're talking about, like prescripting or even reading your judge, those are more things that you either do during the round or that you're just doing sitting on your computer. This one really gets you talking and builds you as a speaker, not just builds your arguments. My first and probably favorite drill is the dreaded 10-minute cross-examination. This is where I let one of my students read their case, and then I come up and cross-examine them for 10 minutes. They hate it. They are terrified. Oh, it's really intense. But also, let's talk through the advantages, and we'll explain kind of how it works as we go. Why to do it? A, for the examiner, it's okay. For the examiner, it teaches you how to really push your opponent. When you have to cover 10 minutes of cross-examination, it teaches you how to not just skim over arguments and not just be addressing the, asking, you can only ask them so many times what the tagline to their first contention is. It's really good to get you to, forces you to start looking deeper into their case. For the examinee, it teaches you how to stay calm under pressure. When you're being cross-examined for 10 minutes straight, it's very stressful. Even being cross-examined for 3 minutes can be very stressful. But after you've been cross-examined for 10 minutes, it's going to make 3 minutes seem like a breeze to answer all their questions. See, it also helps you to know your case. When someone is actually tearing apart every intimate detail of your case for 10 minutes of cross-examination, it really teaches you what all the different weak points of your case are going to be. D, it helps get rid of crutch words. When you have to sit up there for 10 minutes, you have to really speak more clearly, especially as the examinee. As the examinee, you're having to answer questions time and time again, and you begin to get used to it, and that helps you get rid of crutch words. The other drills we're going to talk about later are specifically aimed at crutch words, but this one's helpful. The second one is John's.
All right. Second speaking drill that we're going to talk about is called the bell. And this is how it works. First of all, you find a non-scripted speech to deliver. So this can be anything from an impromptu speech where you have your outline but not all the words you're going to say. Or it could be a debate speech, like an old 1AR that you want to go back through. And you stand up and you deliver this non-scripted speech. And then you have an audience member hold a bell or a gong or other noise-making device. When we did this in my club, I brought this little mini gong that I had. It was called the Ultimate Gong of Ultimate Destiny. Which is what we called it because it was cool and it made that gong sound. And what you do is every time that you say the word or or make some sort of verbal pause like that, that person rings the bell. And your goal is to get through as much of the speech as you can, preferably the whole speech, without making any verbal pauses. So without ever going, I'm going to talk about this now. And when you do this, you ring the bell. there's two ways you can do this drill. Either A, you ring the bell every time they make a verbal pause and you count how many rings there are by the end of the speech, or B, they go until there's a ring and then they sit down and you have it timed and you write down what their time was. Then you have the next person get up and your goal is to go the longest of anyone in your group. So you can make it either competitive or, you know, less competitive. Either you can compete with yourself or you can compete with others. As if you compete with yourself, it's you're trying to lower the amount of times that the gong or the bell rang while you were speaking. So this is a really great speaking drill for, like Matt said, eliminating crutch words. Sometimes crutch words aren't actually words at all. They're sounds that we make in order to fill space, because this is uncomfortable. We don't like silence. And so when you're speaking and you're up there and everyone's looking at you and you're talking, you said, now my opponent brought up this argument, here's my response to it. And you look down at your, you know, your flow pad and you're trying to figure out what argument to address next. Just going like this. We're now going to talk about this. Like, makes people very uncomfortable, and hopefully you don't have to spend that much time to find it. But a lot of times people will say, now that we've covered that, we're going to talk about this. And it's just you don't even think about it. You just automatically do it to fill the dead air so that there's not this heavy silence. And we want to get away from that in speech and debate, because that's considered an unprofessional habit to say the word or make sounds like that a lot when you're trying to think and don't quite know what to say. It's better to be silent for a second than to make a verbal pause for a few seconds. So that's the second speaking.
And one thing I can add to that is also it's not just ums or us. It can be the word like. Well, it's kind of like, you know, like. You know is another one. You know when it's like, you know, so, well can be one. Well, now, looking at this one, all those kinds of words are also crutch words. So keep a lookout. There was an right there. Oh, my goodness. Keep a lookout for all those crutch words and crutch sounds and have other people look for it. That was intentional. That was intentional. All right, the third drill is the pencil in mouth. This is probably one of the most common speaking drills. How you do it is, first of all, you put a pencil or pen halfway in your mouth.
Do not take my pencil. I will demonstrate for you, but you're
okay.
Putting your
mouth okay. Upon all right. All right. All right. I got rid of my pencil. Anyways, you put the pencil halfway in your mouth and you start talking. You
Hello, can. My name is John Bateman.
No, that's right. You can use this to give your cases or even to practice rebuttals. How about having an entire debate round where both of the members had to speak with pencils in their mouth? I made a couple of my students do that once. It was really, really fun to watch. This works great with speech, by the way, too. This is not just a debate drill. Practice giving your speeches with this, especially limited preps and platform speeches.
Most of the speaking drills that we're bringing up are not just debate related. They definitely help for speech as well.
The exception is cross-examination, but even that is going to definitely help your speaking. Here's some reasons why to do it. First of all, it's going to improve your enunciation, clarity of speech. It'll cut back on crutch words, and it will help you talk faster. Not necessarily recommended, but if you ever need to, having that mouth dexterity is really important. This is how it works. When you have something like the pencil in your mouth, it forces you to open up your mouth. If I was going to talk the same way I'm talking with the pencil in my mouth all the time, I'm talking like this, just so that I can get my mouth around the pencil that's sitting in my mouth. It's making it so hard to talk. So once you take that out, it's that much easier to speak more clearly. This is really important if you have, like, say, a lisp, or if your mouth is being closed a lot. It's funny, yeah. Americans apparently actually really close our mouths a lot when we talk. I went and talked to a girl from Colombia. She came here. She spoke really good English. I was like, out of curiosity, what does English sound like to you? Like, how does it sound different to you? She said, You guys garble all your words. You like you're talking with your mouth closed all the time. And because, you know, with Spanish, it's all very open. They end everything with an open vowel. Like, they can't say the word squirrel. It's just too hard. It's like squirrel. They say, like, escuele or something like that, just to open it up a little bit.
Just a final note on this pencil in your mouth. Now, obviously, you didn't use a pencil, but as far as we know, the oldest historical record of a speaking drill is actually based upon this. There's a Greek speaker named Demosthenes. And Demosthenes had a lisp, like really heavy lisp, and he talked really softly. And so he tried to get up in front of the group of assembled Athenian citizens and, present his opinions and that, and no one could hear him or understand him because he had this lisp and he talked softly. So what he started doing was going down to the ocean near Athens and putting smooth pebbles in his mouth and talking with the pebbles in his mouth to get himself used to overemphasizing his words. And he would also stand down there with the waves crashing up against the shore, which, by the way, beaches in Greece are not these beautiful, sandy beaches. It's kind of like
cliffs.
water slamming against cliffs. So imagine, thousands of tons of water slamming against the cliff every couple seconds, and you're trying to deliver a speech over that with pebbles in your mouth. And that's what he did to strengthen his voice and to get rid of his lisp. So this pencil in your mouth drill is actually, the ideas behind it go back at least 3,000 years.
That is awesome.
Just
last reason to do it is it gives a great chance to laugh at your club mates as you see them trying to talk with a pencil in their mouth.
Always fun.
Don't do it with pebbles though, because you might swallow them.
Yeah, that's not always. No. Yeah, we don't recommend the pebble method anymore. That's why we use the pencil method.
Yes.
Anyway, so the next drill we're going to talk about is 2-minute 1ARs. 1ARs are considered the hardest speech of the round because you're responding to 7 minutes of content in only 4 minutes. So what this drill does is teaches you how to get really good at efficiently responding to things in your 2AR. The way that you do it is that you go through your old flows and find an old 1AR that you gave, the flow of an old 1AR that didn't go very well. Like a 1AR where you had lots of stuff written down to cover, and you only covered half of it. You felt like you spent way too much time on it. Then what you do is you deliver your whole speech again, but you time yourself and you do it in under 2 minutes. You set the timer to 2 minutes and you do that, which means however much you were able to fit in before, you now only have half the time to fit that in. What that means is you have to really emphasize quickly responding to things, which doesn't mean that you necessarily talk really, really, really fast like this and lose all your enunciation, no one can understand what you're saying. What it means is that you get really good at using 4-point refutation, which we talked about earlier, and saying, my opponent said this, my response is this, my reasoning behind my response is this, this matters because of this, on to the next point. And you'll be surprised by how quickly you can start burning through points, and how easy it becomes to give this 1AR that you thought was impossible to do in 4 minutes, in 2 minutes. I've actually done with a group of people a 1-minute 1AR, where they managed to get through everything they brought up in a previous 1AR in 4 minutes. They did it all in 1 minute. And of course, they weren't going into a whole lot of detail like you would in an actual speech, but they got through all their points using 4-point refutation, and it's just really good to help you remember to use 4-point refutation and to help you get through your 1ARs faster.
Travis actually had me do that once, and he had me do it, and without speeding up, I easily covered everything I had time to spare. And what he had is one way of doing this is that you give them 10 seconds per argument, regardless of what the argument is. So that's another version of the same drill. But then he had me do it in 5 seconds. I had 5 seconds per argument, and I was not allowed to speed up my argumentation. So, crazy stuff. All right, speed and volume drills. This is when I do need two of your pens for John, but I'm not going to put them in my mouth.
Then you may borrow them.
Okay. It actually doesn't matter if it's a pen. It could be any object, but I think pens are really useful. How you do this is that you have someone hold up an object that represents either volume or speed. So let's say that this is the speed pen. When the object goes up, you have to increase your volume or speed. In fact, do you want to do this for me?
Sure.
Awesome. Yes, okay. When it goes up, you increase your volume or speed. When it goes down, you decrease your volume or speed. And after you try them separately, do them both at once. So let's just do one at a time at first.
So we're going to have this be the volume pen. Blue pen is volume.
Ancient Chinese general Sun Tzu once said, "All war is deception. The first stage of war is for government to lose accountability. Without accountability, actions have no repercussions. Without repercussions, everything is fair game. When everything is fair game, there's nothing to stop a government from harming its citizens. It is because I believe that accountability is necessary. For government to system is the same result that privacy is not undervalued." Webster's Dictionary, privacy says... Yes, definitely.
So this one was speed, apparently. This one's volume. And so this one, he's going to get softer or louder.
All right, so... Ancient Chinese general Sun Tzu once said, "All war is deception. The first stage of war is for government to lose accountability. Without accountability, actions have no repercussions. Without repercussions, everything is fair game. And everything is fair game. There's nothing." Anyways.
And you can do both. And that's even more fun. Correct?
That one is really intense.
It is.
And you're trying to go, like, you're talking really fast like this. And then you have to slow down. So anyways.
Being in loud and slow is actually really hard.
Yes, it is.
You want to get faster as you get louder.
Yep. So why to do it is, first of all, it gives you greater control over your speed and volume. Right there, I had okay control over speed and volume, but I was getting ahead of myself and my tongue was getting all tied up. Because I haven't actually done like any speaking since Nationals. So you definitely want to practice this one. Second of all, it allows you to become a more interesting speaker. Nothing is more boring than someone talking like this for the whole time. They never inflect their voice. They never raise volume. They never speed up. They just talk at the same speed the entire time. It's really dull. And I actually had someone who started and ended and everything in between with their speech just like this. Now, he was a really excellent debater. He was really smart. He had a lot of good content, just like I do right now. But unfortunately, he was just so concentrated on his arguments, he had absolutely no control over his speed and volume. Compare that to talking more like this, when it allows you to actually emphasize certain words that are important. And it also allows you to speed over things that really aren't that important. Now, my opponent had this argument, but we see it doesn't matter for these three reasons. And when you're really coming up to the climax of your point, you can slow down and raise the volume just enough for your judge to get the point. It's much more interesting to listen to. Oh, that's what I just said. Slow down on the punchlines. John? All right.
The sixth drill that we're going to talk about is called vocal warm-ups. And unlike the other drills, which are specific things that you would do to prep for this, this is really more of a life skill that helps with speech and debate. So we're going to talk about when to do it. One, it's just good to do it in general, but you should also do it every morning during a tournament. I don't know about you, but I woke up this morning and my voice was like... And I would try speaking in the morning. I was like, "Travis, how are you doing this morning?" And Travis is like, "John, are you chain smoking? Are you okay?" I'm like, "No, I'm fine." And so that you obviously don't want to get up in front of your judge and be like, "Genocide is an intolerable evil." So you need to warm up. Yeah, you need to warm up your voice to the day. So why do we do it? We do it to avoid injuring your voice. Even though it was like the natural status or status of my voice in the mornings, talking like this actually really harms your voice. And that, like, right now my voice is actually hurting a little bit more than it was based off of just the example I gave you. You don't want to talk down here in your neck. You want your breathing and your voice to come from your diaphragm. So here's how we warm up our voice. First and easiest thing to do, and I do this most mornings when I've been talking a lot the day before, is humming. Because when you hum, everyone hum really quick for me. Feel that vibration all up in here? That is warming up all the muscles in your face and in your throat that help you make sound. And so I would get up in the morning, and a lot of times, because it depends on how much I talked the previous day, and I talked a lot yesterday because I had lectures and that, I woke up this morning and I went, like, that was my attempt to hum, and I was like, "All right, this means I have to do more vocal warm-ups this morning." So I got into the shower and standing there, humming to break things up in there and get the body loose and going again. The next thing you can do are what are called sirens. Sirens are fun, although they kind of mess with your opponent. Not opponent, sorry, your roommates. Your roommates are not your opponent.
I was like, this could be interesting.
Sit at your table. It's the next step after humming. Because humming is just that low end of your register. You're going, and it's very low and very down in here. And then you go up as high as you can to exercise your voice of getting up. Because in the morning, my voice is probably at this octave, down here. It's really low. By about this time in the day, my voice is up to this octave. By the time it gets to evening and I'm tired again, my
sounds
voice
like
drops
a hamster.
Down to this octave. So I exercise getting up to the normal octave of my speaking voice, and you do this through a siren, which would sound something like this. You go from the bottom to the top and back down to the bottom again. So you go...
It's an Asian or a European siren, not an American one.
Yeah, apparently. Yeah, but yeah, you don't want to go. That's not exercising your voice. You're going as low as you can go to as high as you can go and back down. And it exercises your voice. Like, as high as I went just now, which wasn't that high, I could not have gotten up that high this morning when I first woke up because my voice was like, blah. And the third thing that you can do is tongue twisters. And this is so we don't stumble on words like Merriam-Webster's dictionary.
Like, or undervalued.
But yeah, so one of my favorites is Chester Cheetah Chewed a Chunk of Cheap Cheddar Cheese. And I do a lot of musical theater, and in musical theater we do vocal warm-ups before each show. And so a lot of times, you know, we'll do scales, and it's like, la 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 la, la 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 la, you know, that type of thing. That can get kind of annoying. Tongue twisters are really cool to do scales with, though, but you do them on the single note. So you go, Chester Cheetah chewed a chunk of cheap cheddar cheese. Chester Cheetah chewed a chunk of cheap cheddar cheese. Chester Cheetah chewed a chunk of cheap cheddar cheese. Chester Cheetah chewed a chunk of cheap cheddar cheese. And by the point that I've gone all the way up there, I've just exercised out my voice and had to keep pretty good diction while I'm doing that. Doing these things with your voice sounds weird to other people. That's why you laugh at me so much. It also sounds weird to yourself, and it'll feel weird. But what it'll keep you from doing is losing your voice at debate tournaments. I can't tell you the amount of debate tournaments that by day three, my voice was gone. And that until I started doing this more often, and then my voice got stronger. Your vocal cords are muscles. The more you use them, it's just like the more you use your arm muscles. They get bigger and stronger. And
you can end up like me instead of John.
Something like that. Colorado kids.
Sorry.
Just because I have a hard time breathing up here. But anyway, so what you want to do is get in the habit of doing these things, especially during tournaments, because by day three of the tournament, your hope is to be in the final round of debate, right? But if you can't speak in the final round, and that happened to me once. I was trying to talk, and I was like, Judge, God. And the judge was like, I couldn't understand a word you said, and I was like, ah. So yeah, you don't want to do that. And this is how we avoid doing that with vocal warm-ups.
Can I tell a little story with that? Because yeah. Then this is your point again. Yeah. Actually, a friend of mine, Cheyenne. Do you know Cheyenne?
Yeah, Cheyenne Awesome.
At a New Mexico tournament, awesome. Lost her voice completely. She had to talk like this, literally. She could not talk any louder. Oh, it was so terrible. And then she had to debate me in round four, which is actually an important round, if you know, like, the way that
the last
matchups go. Yeah. Well, plus it kind of helps determine who you debate in round five and six. But in any case, not that I try to get into that stuff, but anyways, the judge could not hear anything she was saying. It was terrible. Like, I could hear what she was saying, but the judge couldn't. And I felt terrible, and obviously I won that round, but she didn't break. And also, she didn't break in any of her speeches because her voice was so gone. Actually, diet has a bit to do with that also. If you have a ton of sugar, that's definitely bad for your voice.
Water is good for your voice.
Yes. Notice that we're drinking lots of water.
Yeah. Especially after doing that blah voice. I was like, need to drink more water. So the fourth key to improving your ability... Oh,
I was
question.
Hot tea is really good for those too.
Especially lemon tea.
Yeah, but not coffee. I don't know why.
Yeah,
No.
Caffeine is actually really bad. Because here's what caffeine does to your system. Mm. It pulls all the water out of your system. And water is how your system keeps... It's water is like the lubricant of the engine of your voice. If oil in a car is what keeps the parts from grinding together. Water is what keeps your vocal cords from grinding together and killing one another. Coffee is sucking the water out of there, and so then your vocal cords are just like, ah. Yeah.
I love how you use your arms for just absolutely everything.
He does.
I do.
Yeah.
And that Matt's scared, I'm going to whap him in the face on accident at some point. But the fourth key to improving your delivery is getting comfortable with your opponent. And this means a couple of things. First of all, get to know your opponent a little bit before the round. And that, you know, ask them, what's your name? Where are you from? Because it's really bad sometimes in rounds, like your opponent will get up for cross-sex and be like, so Matt, how are you doing today? And then if you're Matt and you go, I'm doing really good, I forget your name. You know, if they
I'm doing good. How about you?
Yeah, exactly. It's generally accepted if someone greets you by name, like, hey, Matt, how's it going?
Oh, pretty good, John, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, although, don't say it like that, actually.
Yeah, not in debate.
Hey, dude, like, John.
What's up, man?
That's not good for debate. But anyway, you want to get to know your opponent a little bit before the round, if you have time. Like, if you're waiting for the judge to get there, don't sit there awkwardly at your table and looking at your opponent like... instead, spend that time to be like, so... Where are you from? Where people are from actually has a huge impact on how they debate, because it has an impact on what arguments they consider to be normal arguments and what arguments they think are weird. For instance,
Texans.
Yeah. Also, what political beliefs they have. For instance, most homeschoolers are of
the persuasion.
Most conservatives are of the persuasion that, yeah, gun rights are a good thing, but maybe there's a limit. Like, we shouldn't let people have nuclear bombs. This seems like a bad idea. I once debated a Texan, and I was like, but you would agree that we shouldn't allow people to have nuclear bombs, so there needs to be a limit somewhere. And they're like, no, if they have the money to privately fund nuclear research, then they have the right to own nuclear weapons. They're like, so let's get this straight. You would advocate Coca-Cola having a stock of nuclear weapons. Like, if they can afford it and the free market will support it, then yes. Ron Paul told me so.
Yeah, like, and you see, your judge is like, oh my goodness, yeah. Let it know.
But this was in Texas, so the judge was like, wait, stick to your guns. Ha ha ha. Wasn't I funny there?
You're like, punny.
Yeah, how much punny are you? Anyway, but yeah, so get to know your opponent a little bit before the round. During the round, be respectful but not stiff. For instance, like we were saying, you know, the greeting for cross-sex, you wouldn't want to be like, what up, homie? You're like, you know, that's just not going to go over well. You'd want to say, how are you doing today, Matt? But you wouldn't want to be like, how are you today, Matt? You know?
How are you feeling today, good sir?
Yeah, that stiffness is really weird, and it makes you look uncomfortable. And like we just demonstrated, always greet your opponent in cross-sex. It's a formality, but if you hop up there and they're like, all right, so you brought up in your case, and then the opponent and the judges are pretty much all used to this greeting, and so when you don't do that, it makes it look like you're being harsh. You really aren't. It's just that's what people expect.
Here's one exception that some people will disagree on. If the negative came up and cross-examined you and you already had the greeting, and asked you how you were and you asked there and you all said you're fine, it's kind of weird as the affirmative get up and say, so how are you doing?
Yeah.
It's like, we just covered this.
Yeah.
So as the affirmative cross-examining the negative, you can just pretty much jump right in. I mean, still be nice, but like, all right, Matt, you know, do the greeting, but just like, all right, Matt, I'd like to start with this. And you're still greeting, but you're not doing the whole thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And then next point is to remember that your opponent is attacking your arguments, not you.
Hopefully.
In the majority of cases. Hopefully. You know, if Matt was bringing up an argument, he was like, Judge, my opponent has crazy hair, therefore vote against him. Then he's obviously attacking you, not your arguments. But most of the time in debate, you know, even to a point, like when Matt and I debated, I called one of his arguments ridiculous.
Well, I called one of his absurd on its face.
Yes, exactly. So... it takes a certain level of maturity to realize that when people are using such strong language as ridiculous, absurd on its face, wholly morally bankrupt, or, you know, things like this.
Or communist.
Yes, or communist, heaven forbid. I'm not saying that Matt is wholly absurd upon his face. I am saying that the argument he presented is. And you want to be polite, for sure, but recognize that it is the job of the other person to contradict you. And getting comfortable with your opponent reduces the chance of ad hominem attacks. So first of all, for the most part, your opponent is going to attack your arguments, not you. Second of all, even when they are attacking you, if you've gotten comfortable with them beforehand, it's not going to happen as much or it's not going to be as bad. Now, I have a different lecture on logical fallacies, but one of them is called ad hominem, which is Latin for attacking the man. And what this means is that rather than attacking the argument, saying why the argument's bad, you're saying why the person who made the argument is bad.
Not always your opponent, but it could be even the source.
Yeah, exactly. So like, for instance, if someone said, President Obama in a joint session of Congress stated that we need to increase our national defense. Then the other person got up and said, well, President Obama may have said that, but that's ridiculous. He's a Muslim. Why would he want to increase national defense? That's not addressing the argument. That's attacking the man. And there's absolutely no evidence to support the fact that, or the assertion, not the fact, the assertion, President Obama is a Muslim. But that's a separate issue. The idea here being, though, that if you get comfortable with your opponent beforehand, you get to know each other, you're less likely to be mean to, and they are less likely to be mean to you if you both kind of have this relationship beforehand. Because, especially like when I've debated friends, you get done with the round and you still want to be friends afterwards. Whereas people that I don't know at all, you're like, I really don't care if I hurt their feelings. And that's an attitude you don't want to have. You want to be like, I want to, you know, still be on good terms with this person when the round ends. Well, yes, I'm going to try my best to beat them, but I'm not going to go overboard with it.
Number five, the last one is to prioritize arguments. Amen. And I've talked about this a little bit with you guys, but let's go into depth with it. This is really something that you do during prep time. In fact, this is more important even than writing down your arguments in prep time, I believe. You can usually look at an opponent's argument if you're good enough and just come up with a response. But by looking at the different arguments, you can understand which ones are the most important. And so you guys may have heard this, but time equals important. The more time you spend on an argument, the more important it is going to be in the judge's mind. It's kind of this paradox. You can't just tell the judge what the most important arguments are in the round. Although you certainly want to do so in the form of, first of all, your contentions, and second of all, at the very end, you're going to tell them in your voting issues. But say you have this argument, you think it's really good, but you only spend 10 seconds on it, and you just kind of touch on it, and then you spend 2 minutes on Phoenician warships. For the judge, the most important argument, the one that they are going to remember the most, is the Phoenician warships that you've been talking about for 2 hours as you explain all the difference between bireme and trireme warships and all of these kinds of things. That is exactly what they are going to remember the most. So time equals importance. That is possibly the greatest and most well-recognized rule of communication, is that the more time you spend on a point, the most important it's going to appear to other people. So if you can take anything out of this whole lecture, I really, especially out of this fifth key, because it all stems from this idea, is that time equals importance. The arguments you want your judge to remember are the ones you need to spend time on. So with that understood, the first category is you want to pick arguments that you have to win. These are arguments that unless you win them, it's all over. Everything's done. And this, you're going to pick two or three of these at the most. Maybe four. There might be a fourth argument that you have to win, but usually this is two or three. An argument that you would have to win, for example, would be something like critiquing the resolution. Your argument, your key argument about why the resolution is flawed, if you're the negative. Or it would be your argument about why your value is important. If the values aren't an issue in the debate round, then you're instantly only going to have one or two important issues, just to let you know. The second one that you want to do are arguments that you want to win. These are basically things that make you look good. Now, logically, these aren't necessarily the most important, but they are really nice to have. This would be like, for example, say the third response to your opponent's value. You don't need to win it, but it would sure be really nice to. It's not essential to your case, but it's really nice. Or maybe this would be like an application that you really like. Now, I could get away with not winning this, but I definitely want to win it. It makes me look good. The third category is unimportant side issues. And it's really important to acknowledge what the unimportant side issues are. So let's look at have to win arguments and ones that you want to highlight to your judge. These are issues you want to boil the round into. These will become, to win arguments are your voting issues. Even if you haven't called them that yet, they are your voting issues. So believe it or not, you will be determining your voting issues if you're the affirmative in your second speech, in your first affirmative rebuttal. Your voting issues are already going to become apparent. You're not going to call them voting issues, but you need to know what your voting issues are. If once I get further into the year, often I'll know what my voting issues are before I even walk into the room, because they're part of my case. These should all be offensive, not defensive arguments. And we talked about what offensive and defensive arguments are. Want-to-win arguments are important to you. There are often issues in your case that weren't really contended by your opponent. Almost all defensive arguments are unimportant side issues. Cross-apply these when possible, and you want them to drop off the flow. You don't really want your judge to remember those. These are the arguments that you practice giving 5, 10, at the most 15 seconds responses to, and move on. And that's the end of the show. I hope you guys enjoyed 5 Ways to Improve Your Delivery.
Do you have any questions?